Good morning. I will call the meeting of the Civil and Data Privacy Committee to order. Do I have a motion to move the minutes from March 22nd? Representative Johnson moves the minutes of March 22nd. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of approval of the March 22nd minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Representative McNamara, you are up first. We're going to go right to House File 1598. Representative Grunhagen is going to move House File 1598. And recommend it be re-referred to the Transportation Committee.
Madam Chair, I'd like to just modify the referral that it go to House Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee. You weren't aware of that, but that's my committee, and the chair of that committee would like to see the bill before it goes to transportation, and that's me.
Okay. All right. Representative Johnson will renew his motion that it be re-referred to the Environment Committee. All right.
Madam Chair, that would be great. And now I have at least two members doing the referral, so I'm glad. And Representative Smith had told me he would like to move the bill, too, so that would be terrific.
Well, we could have three co-movers.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry for the disturbance.
No, that's all right. Representative McNamara, to your bill. And today, by the way, we're only taking up the portion in the bill that relates to the civil penalties. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, if I could move, or if Representative Johnson could move the A1 to get the bill in the shape I would like, then I would explain it.
Representative Johnson moves the A1 to the shape to get the bill in the shape that the author would prefer. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1
Chair,
is adopted.
We are before the committee because and the amendment was to the committee. It changed the misdemeanor to a petty misdemeanor that will allow it to be a civil citation where it can be just addressed without having to go to court. And Madam Chair, we are delaying the effective date to give more time for people. It's more about voluntary compliance and not about more enforcement. It deals with ditch mowing, and under current law, you're not supposed to mow ditches before August 1st, and we're just clarifying what current law is and allowing time for all the folks to work together to have a meaningful bill. And it still needs some more discussion, Madam Chair, between the ag interests and the different road authorities and folks, and that's why it's going back to Environment Committee, or going to Environment Committee, before it goes back to Transportation, where it's already passed once, but it'll probably go back to there, Madam Chair.
All right. Are there any questions on the bill? Representative Lesh.
Okay, so I realize this isn't the Ag Committee, but what in the world? What's the dispute about who gets to mow before or after the first, and who's arguing about that?
Representative McNamara.
Representative Lesh, it centers around hay is more valuable before August 1st as far as its food quality, but ground nesting birds don't like getting mowed over before August 1st, so it actually can get quite emotional for some folks with the issue and current law. And so as much as it seems like a simple bill, but some of the smallest, simplest bills do bring up some controversy.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other member questions? Seeing none, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 1598 be re-referred to the Committee on... What? Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify for or against this bill? I think there's someone making their way forward. Okay, and please just keep your comments to the civil penalties. That's the reason that the bill is in our committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape, please. Thank
you. Madam Chair. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we appreciate the changes that are made in this bill, and I do appreciate the chance to be on the record that this is going to be a petty misdemeanor and not a misdemeanor. It's a very odd bill. It is not followed universally across the state, and it's not enforced. And so now we're going to be enforcing a law that we haven't been, and we're going to be It's just a different situation because ditches are mowed universally throughout the state, no matter what highway you travel on in western and northwestern Minnesota. And so the other piece of it that is very important that Representative McNamara is doing is he's delaying out the date. Essentially, farmers would have this year and next year before they would have a penalty because the penalty doesn't go into effect till August 1st of next year. And so we need an education component from MnDOT to say now they're going to start enforcing the law, and from farm organizations, maybe the Department of Ag, to tell people they're going to start writing them a ticket now for doing something they've been doing for many years. And so I appreciate the changes Representative McNamara made, and we'll continue to work with him. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Is there anyone else wishing to testify for or against the bill? Please come up to the desk. Thank you. Welcome, and introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
And thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Erin Roop. I'm here today on behalf of and a member of the Minnesota Honey Producers Association. So it's the industry group of mostly commercial beekeepers in our state. There are about 300 people. We manage on average about 2,000 colonies. And it's commercial beekeepers' job. Most of us aren't in the state at this time of year because of things like almond pollination. So Dan Whitney, this statement is from him. He's the president of the honey producers, and he's currently in Texas raising queens for his industry and other beekeepers. So here's the end statement. On behalf of the 300 members of the Minnesota Honey Producers Association, I am contacting you in support of House File 1598, a bill to enhance roadside habitat for nesting birds and other small wildlife. As you know, pollinators, in particular our honeybee population in Minnesota, are under great stress. In 2015, Minnesota beekeepers reported more than 50% losses of our hives. This is an unsustainable model that is driving commercial beekeepers out of the business. Minnesota ranks fifth in the U.S. for total agricultural cash receipts. With 75% of the leading food crops dependent on pollinators, this should be a concern for everyone in the state of Minnesota. The USDA report on honey production this week showed that commercial honey production was down 12% from 2015. The decline represents a 3% decrease in managed bee colonies and a 10% drop in the average yield per colony. The bee industry is in crisis. There has been a steep decline in pollinator habitat, which affects the nutrition available for honeybees. Anything that the state of Minnesota can do to increase food for pollinators will help stop this steep decline in bee population. The Minnesota Honey Producers Association strongly supports this proposal to curb mowing of ditches before August 1st by making mowing without a permit a petty misdemeanor. The current mowing law is being broken without any consequences, other than that we are losing critical pollinator habitat in our ditches, and we have hungry bee colonies in the fall. We know our bees rely on habitat along roadsides. Given the crop monoculture in our rural areas, the flowers in the ditches are, in some cases, the only food available for our bees. We are hopeful that your efforts to improve pollinator habitat will be successful. The Minnesota Honey Producers Association is ready to help in any way that we can. Sincerely, Dan Whitney, President, Minnesota Honey Producers. And Dan's from Otter Tail County. His sons and his wife are there now while he's in Texas. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Seeing no one. I'm sorry, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe someone can answer me this question. I've heard it referenced several times in testimony that we're making this a petty misdemeanor. Is that accurate, Representative Neckermeyer?
Correct.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, we did the adopted the A1 amendment.
Okay. I missed the amendment then. And so that was done here. So are we doing criminal law amendments in the civil law committee, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I'm in discussion with Representative Cornish on whether or not the bill will go to his committee. Is that what the question is about?
Representative Lesh.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, it looks like we've got a misdemeanor and a civil penalty, and I really don't have an opinion as to whether or not it should go to Representative Cornish's committee, but I'm just a little sensitive about what people think is civil versus criminal, because a petty misdemeanor is still criminal. I just want to be clear, it's just doesn't happen to be, a crime.
Representative Lesh, just to point you to line 2.18 and 2.19 of the bill, the penalty for a violation of this section is a misdemeanor. Well, it's a petty misdemeanor now, and a civil penalty equal to the value of the vegetation taken.
Yep.
So, does that help you in any way?
No, I saw that. That's why I asked the question, Madam Chair. But Representative McNamara is talking with Representative Corner, so I think that's fine.
Okay. All right.
And Madam Chair, I do want to clarify, and Representative Lesh brings up a great point. It's absolutely not our intention for it to be a criminal penalty. And this is, I'm outside my area of expertise, but just in conversations with folks, the intent would be, I understand a civil penalty does not require a court appearance, and it's the intent that this would be, if someone did get a ticket, that it would be written up as a civil penalty that they could pay without having to go to court and having to incur those kind of costs. That's what the intent of the bill is, and that's why I have not finished. My only preliminary conversation with Chair Cornish was that he wants to understand exactly what we're doing.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, a petty misdemeanor, if you pay a petty misdemeanor ticket, it's still a criminal conviction. Okay, it does not count as a crime in the state of Minnesota because it's only a crime under definition of statute if there is potential jail time, and that's only at a misdemeanor level or above. So it would be the equivalent to a speeding ticket. If you go in and apply for a job and they ask if you've been convicted, which not anymore, but have you been convicted of a crime, you can say no if you've had a speeding ticket because it's a speeding ticket, but it still technically qualifies as criminal, comes down on your state of Minnesota driving record as criminal. So just so you're aware of that, it is technically criminal, just not a crime.
Representative, I think Representative Schoen was next, and then Representative Johnson, then Representative Silstrom.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it follows with Representative Lesh. So is it your intent that when I'm working and somebody's mowing, your constituent is mowing along Highway 61 when he's not supposed to be and I get called down there, is it your intent that I would issue him a citation when this comes down as a Cottage Grove police officer? Or if you're looking for a civil violation, then, or civil, basically, who is going to be the authority that is going to levy the citation or levy the fine or the penalty, if you will? Is that, do you know that? Because, I mean, Representative Lesh is right. So if I hand you a citation for speed or whatever it may be, unless it's a Hastings or Cottage Grove City ordinance violation, then it goes through the criminal courts. It doesn't mean that anybody has to appear in court, but they still have to technically plead guilty to speed when they pay the fine, even though it's not criminal, but it's an unlawful act, which still is in the criminal statutes. And so that might be where we should check with the commissioner of DNR, that would they just send out a letter with a civil demand if there is such a violation instead of issuing a citation on spot? Kind of an issue. Is that kind of the direction? Because I'm kind of concerned about that too. Because I could see if I'm up in Itasca County or Canyon High County, and a deputy shows up to issue a citation with the farmer, and you know how emotionally charged this is, especially if it's a drought season too. It's going to be a fight, and people get pretty upset over a $100 ticket for something like this rather than otherwise, right?
Chair McNamara.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Schoen, you make a good point, and I like your latter idea, and I'm certainly, this is all about education, and that's why it's pushed out until, it doesn't begin to take effect until after two more growing seasons, even though common practice is to not enforce the law currently, and there is no penalty in the current law. It would be my hope that you as a Cottage Grove police officer and the person that was doing the mowing, if it's over the next 2 years, you'd let them know that this is against the law and it's going to begin to have a penalty in 2017. You should not be doing it now. But I don't want it to become an issue for police officers, so I think you and Representative Lesh have a great idea, and that's something I'll need to work out as going forward, because the second thing you talked about is what our intent would be, that it be very, the penalty would be a last resort, and I would hope that the police officer wouldn't issue a citation, more just let them know that they should have a permit And there will be, you specifically, Representative Schoen, you mentioned one thing, there will be exceptions for drought conditions, just like there is in current law. So there will. It's our intention that there's parameters, and we don't want to. And there's even also some instances where landowners have a right to hay the ditch because of the way the easement's written with the road authority. We're going to clarify that they still have those rights. This does not supersede those rights. So if there's a way to make the penalty softer, I'm all for that, because it's not about the fine.
Chair McNamara, I think what I would like to do is have this sent to Chair Cornish's committee next instead of your committee, so that this can be worked out with his committee. And so I think we'll change the motion here shortly. But Representative Lesh, to this point, and then I've got to go to Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative McNamara, just to give you an idea, and you don't have to take this suggestion, but there are other areas in criminal law that I think try to achieve the same aim that you're trying to achieve in this, where gaining compliance is the number one goal here. And we do that with license tabs. If a cop pulls you over for a license tab violation, the aim of the state is to gain compliance. If you show up to court having bought those, then it is an affirmative defense and gets automatically dismissed, so there's no conviction. That might be another option for you, to establish compliance that maybe the vegetation is paid for or something, but I just wanted to offer another idea that may be more akin to what you're trying to get at in this.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, wish you luck. This is a good idea, but it's very, even though it's a simple bill, it's very complex. In my area, the townships are pushing hard for mowing the ditches and mowing the ditches early because we're having a big issue with wild parsley, which is a very noxious weed. And we also have the issue along the roads, and especially on the township roads at the intersections, where the tall weeds make visibility and makes the intersections dangerous. So it's finding that right balance that you're trying to do to make the roads safe, make the ditches actually safe for kids when they want to play without playing them, but also for the egg industry, such as the bees, to make sure they have the habitat. So I applaud you for trying to make that good balance.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for saying that this should probably go to public safety, because I think that is typically where we deal with these kinds of issues. And I would actually encourage you to look between now and there at the DNR statute, because that's where we see a lot of these, where there are penalties for reimbursing for the price of wildlife. So that's currently in the DNR statute. So when you make this a petty misdemeanor, if there is no criminal penalty in the statute, it automatically is a petty misdemeanor. So if it says no penalty now, it currently is a petty misdemeanor. The question then is, how do you assess the civil penalty? Who determines what the value of that is? How do people find that out? In the DNR section of the statute, if you take a deer, for example, they have a price that you will pay to replace the state for the value of that deer. So my question is, how are you going to figure out that civil penalty portion, and who's going to collect it, who's going to enforce it, who's going to assess it?
Chair McNamara, those...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hillstrom, the thoughts were that we potentially, there's a hay price mechanism that it currently exists that some states use in determining the restitution value if that was needed. We could have MnDOT use a reference like that, that unlike you talked about the value of a deer, a trophy deer has the same value year round and it's not subject to the up and downs of the volatility of hay prices. So there is some challenge in determining for hay. Again, our hope is to not use any of that kind of stuff, and I'm beginning to think maybe the penalty would only be after multiple occurrences to the same person, that we would do something like no penalty. It's just a warning the first time it happens, even in the time past the 2 years, giving it to before it takes effect. So those, I appreciate it's really an education tool, Madam Chair, and I don't want it to be about the penalties, because I mean, the $100, truthfully, you know, we have really egregious things going on right now where people are going out on a long holiday weekend Memorial Day, 4th of July, and bailing up thousands of bales on highway right-of-way illegally. And come Tuesday, when people come back to work, it's all gone. The habitat's destroyed and gone, and there's no implications, even if somebody can say, well, the hay is right over in Denny McNamara's yard, and he baled it all. You know, the whole family was out there all weekend with a tractor that wasn't even legally right to be on that premise. So we've got some serious things going on, some safety issues and such that we're trying to deal with. But at the same time, this law has not been enforced for decades.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I just want to make sure that we have the mechanism in the event you want to enforce it. So if you have an egregious act, and not the people who do it by mistake or not the people who do it once, but you have an egregious act like that, the question really is then who would assess the civil penalty? How is that assessed, right? And then how is it collected? So is, like in the DNR statute, for example, it is issued as a restitution order as part of the criminal case. So someone has to tell the prosecutor this is what the value is. So I'm just trying to get a sense of how that civil penalty might work. And between now and public safety, maybe we should talk about that.
And Madam Chair, the...
Yes, Representative McNamara.
MnDOT, DNR, the farm ag groups, we heard from the pollinator folks. They're all in the audience listening to this good discussion. And so we'll bring... Those are folks on all different sides of this issue, and see if we can collaborate together, because I think they're very thoughtful discussions. Some of this I didn't completely understand, and I do better understand it now. It's not been a committee that I've spent much time in, and I haven't spent a lot of time in the legal system either. So that's probably good,
yeah,
I guess, in
good.
Some respects.
Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, and I maybe want to get Representative McNamara's input on this, but I know we're all short on time this year with committee time, and especially so in public safety, but I'd kind of, if he's willing to take it back to his committee and maybe sort out the entire package before it came to public safety to try to rehash this entire process. I mean, if he has a penalty mechanism or a different thing he wants to do, get it put together and packaged in his own committee before it came with, then so that when everybody comes down at public safety, we can spend a short amount of time on it. And if there's something we need to hash out there, but it would be nice from my perspective on all the other bills that we still have to work with before the first deadline, that it that we let him do what he needs to do in his own committee with all the experts there on the natural resource side, and then they could probably figure out what those penalties are, how that mechanism might work with the commissioner before it comes to public safety. It's just a thought process and where my mind might go with it. I'm certainly not going to object to going to public safety if that's where you want it to go. I'm just trying to help economize all our time and all the other things that might be coming back between civil law and public safety as well. That's yet to come.
Chair McNamara, I know that's an option, but it's also an option to work it out, you know, the next day or two before it gets to public safety as well. And then you come in and you have a deal made and everybody's on board. Chair McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schoen is speaking to what my thoughts were, and Representative Cornish serves on my committee. Chair Cornish does. So it was my thought. Some of the issues brought up probably are more in the realm of our committee to get work through. I understand the implications, but Representative Cornish will be able to participate there. I think there's a possibility. I got to be careful saying this, but if we eliminate the penalty, then we probably wouldn't go to Chair Cornish's committee, and that probably would be more appropriate for that discussion to be in Environment and Natural Resources.
All right. The Chair will acquiesce to the Chair of Environment's wishes, and we will once again change the motion. Sorry, staff. We'll once again change the motion. Representative Johnson will finally move the bill, and we'll move it back to your committee. Any other discussion or members of the audience that wish to testify? Seeing none, Representative Johnson changes his motion that House File 1598 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. It's on its way to your committee, Chair McNamara.
Thank you, members. Madam Chair and members.
You bet. Thank you. Next up, Representative Green. Members in the audience, we did change the agenda up just a little bit from what you might be seeing because several of the people giving testimony this morning on their bills are members of the Environment Committee, which is also meeting right now, so we're trying to accommodate that. Welcome to the committee, Representative Green. Representative Grunhagen, would you like to move House File 2603?
Yes. I'll move it.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen moves House File 2603 that it be re-referred to the Committee on Mining and Outdoor Rec. And I believe there is a DE amendment. Am I right, Representative Green?
Yes, Madam Chair. That's correct.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen will move the DE2 amendment. The DE2 is no before move. Us. All those in, any discussion on the DE2? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE2 is before us. And Representative Green, do you have an oral amendment as well?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. On line 1.4, after the word commissioner, insert natural resources, or of natural resources, excuse me.
Of DNR? Or
well, Commissioner of Natural Resources.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All those in favor of the oral amendment for lines 114 to get the bill and the author in the shape the authors wish, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The oral amendment is adopted. Representative Green, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This bill is just, it's a real simple bill. There's agencies that are named in this bill who do purchase a lot of property within Minnesota, and as of now, they're not required to have public hearings. They have open houses, but there's no chance for an exchange between citizens. And what the public hearing will do will allow for people to have input, and these agencies then will be required to answer the questions from the audience in these hearings. It's really very simple, and I think it speaks for itself, so I'll just stand for questions if you have any.
Member questions on House File 2603? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The bill before you today duplicates current law, actually. Currently in 97A.145, the Department of Natural Resources is required to have a meeting with the to have county board approval before we would acquire any wildlife management areas, scientific natural areas, or rim critical habitat easements. In addition to that, we work with county boards talking with them before we would purchase any land within a park boundary, which the legislature has to approve and pass into law the boundaries of a state park or a state forest. So before we do any acquisition, we're working with the county boards, notifying them, having, in essence, if you look at 97A.45, the commissioner must notify the county board and town officers. Actually, it's 97A.145 sub 2, which outlines the acquisition procedure and statute. It says lands purchased or leased under this section must be acquired in accordance with the subdivision. The commissioner must notify the county board and town officers where the land is located and furnish them a description of the land to be acquired. The county board must approve or disapprove the proposed acquisition with 90 days, and then they may extend it up to 30 days. Soil and Water Conservation District supervisors shall counsel the county board on drainage and flood control and the best utilization capability of the land. Goes on to outline other activities that we need to do with the counties. So we feel that the intent of the law is already being covered, first of all, and then the other part of this, providing this public notice, which is the right thing to do, outline it has to be 30 days, but no more than 60 days, be published in a newspaper, a general circulation, state register on our website, mail notice to any person who has requested this. These are fiscal impacts to the agency that need to be discussed as this bill moves forward. So hopefully this bill would go to Environment Policy and Finance Committee where we could outline those costs. They are kind of substantial. We feel the bill would impact probably 60 to 70 acquisitions per year that we would do. So you take that, the staff time required, just the publishing in the state register and the newspapers are costs that we need to discuss if this bill moves forward, Madam Chair.
Representative Green, any response to that?
Yes, I do. The county board meetings are fine, but they're not public hearings. I don't accept the fact that basically we can't have public hearings to notify citizens and allow them to have input into these sales, which will affect them directly within their property taxes, their right to own this property again privately. And to say it's just too hard is not acceptable. This is something that one of the functions that we should have here is protect citizens of the state. And I believe that that's what this bill is trying to do.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, overall I like the concept of this bill. I have townships in my district that over a third of the land is owned by DNR. And it's very tough on the taxpayers in that township. Looking at this bill, it talks about when intent to buy the to purchase land. To me, that's a little vague. One of those mornings. I guess I'd like to see that before it could even move forward, a letter of intent would have to be sent out, and then work as the commissioner or DNR said, they had already do meetings with the county board and the town boards. But I still like the idea of having a public meeting so that people could express their opinions, because when they take this land off the tax rolls, it does affect the people that live there, and it can affect them greatly.
Representative Green, any response?
Yes, I appreciate those comments, but I don't think that it would really apply here. I'll respond a little bit to how much land is out there now. Right now, Minnesota is about 25% publicly owned. You know, we are always dealing with our property tax issues in the state, and they continue to climb, and this is one of the reasons why. Then you take in the easements. Minnesota looks pretty dismal on the map as far as private ownership anymore. And then can you repeat part of that question again?
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, I guess I'm looking at if there'd be a way to have a letter of intent sent to the county boards on the purchase, and then that would kick in the public hearings.
Representative Green, what happens commonly if someone's looking to purchase land is they send out first a letter of intent that they're thinking of purchasing it. So that's kind of the point of reference here. Go ahead, Representative Green.
The letter of intent is fine, and I'm sure that all takes place, but if the letter of intent has to go out before this meeting, and from this meeting it is decided that the land will not be purchased, now there's more expense in that as well. So whether or not they want to do the letter of intent, I guess, is up to them, but I think that until we hear from the people, what is their opinion on this purchase, that might be hard. But that might be a better question for an expert, because maybe a letter of intent is already out.
Any other member questions? Anyone else? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what Representative Johnson's talking about is some type of a triggering mechanism. I like this a lot, having served in county government and seeing what's happening, but that we have a definitive triggering event that necessitates this to happen. My concern is that if it's a little bit ambiguous, that there might be, well, we don't really have to do it now because this hasn't happened yet, and all of a sudden it's too late into the process where it can't be slowed down by public input. So I think it would be nice just to have something definitive that says, if you're going to enter into negotiations to purchase property from the private sector, that you have to maybe enter into a letter of intent first, and then have a time frame on that before a purchase agreement could be done, so that there's a triggering event and everybody knows from that point, if they're going to buy it, that they have to do this process, so that we ensure that this public hearing takes place, rather than kind of slipping it in at the end and then having the public not be able to comment as they might.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against? Looks like we have one other person. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the
good morning
tape, please.
Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Mm-hmm. And just in a quick summary, the Board of Water and Soil Resources does not currently purchase real property in fee. However, we believe that, along with the DNR, that there are adequate procedures in place working with elected officials from soil and water districts and county boards, and that if this were to move forward, we'd like an opportunity to be able to study and report on what the impacts might be, fiscal and otherwise.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Seeing none.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Just real briefly, Madam Chair, and I know there, the folks from the DNR brought up a potential fiscal implication as this moves forward. And I think that may be, but it's somewhat disconcerting to hear the department say that we're going to participate in 70 to 80 transactions a year where we're going to buy private property and transition it to public, and we have the money for that. Mm-hmm. We have all the money to buy the property, but doing notices and making sure the public is aware that we're buying the property, we're not quite sure we have the money for that, and so that's pretty troubling. That's pretty troubling.
Thank you, Representative Ross.
Madam Chair, just to that point, really quick, the dollars we receive for acquisition are very strictly protected. Appropriation from the legislature, that the Outdoor Heritage Fund has constitutional requirements. Game and Fish Fund dollars that we use, our license dollars, have statutory and federal protections around them. These costs may have to be covered out of general fund appropriations. With sufficient wildlife division has no general fund. It's paid by all the sportsmen and women of the state of Minnesota. So I understand your concern, Representative Zerwas, but the department is paid for by people who want to do activities within the natural resources community. Hunters, fishers, snowmobilers, ATVers. We have very limited general fund activities, and what those general funds are there for, to protect water, to do wetlands enforcement and things like that. So our budget is very large, but very compartmentalized and statutorily protected as well. So that's the point I raised on that question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
I guess I would say if this new statutory process is to involve these notices, and that's the process to purchase land, I think it's quite reasonable to think that this would be a part of the process and part of the cost of acquiring public lands. It's not that much of a leap.
Correct. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious as to where it goes for looking at the fiscal implications, or is it going somewhere after this?
This bill, Representative Hillstrom, is going to the Outdoor Mining Recreation Committee. And from there, I don't know what the route is. And then it's going to Environment Finance, so. Seeing no other input from the audience or members, all those in favor of passage of House File 2603 being re-referred to the committee, where's my script? I get it right. On mining and outdoor recreation, I'd like to re-refer House File 2603 as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Mining and Outdoor Recreation. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way.
Thank you.
Green. Thank you. Representative Hackbarth. Here he comes. He's coming on down, running even. Representative Smith, would you like to move House File 2993?
It's so moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, and House File 2993 is being re-referred to Ways and Means. I don't know what I'm doing here. Okay. All right, Representative Hackbarth, through your bill, it's been moved and it's before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Smith. It is very, very quick, so I think we can just move quickly on the bill, but this is the LCCMR bill, and we're here before civil law mainly just for section, I think it's six of the bill.
Yes, it is.
That pertains to public meetings, and this just requires the LCCMR to hold their public meeting, or make their meetings, all their meetings, public, and subject to Chapter 13D.
Wonderful. Any discussion from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 2993 be recommended to pass and re-refer to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. I think that was record time, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Representative Pugh.
Good morning, members.
Good morning, Representative Pugh. Welcome to the committee. And Representative Vogel will move House File 3308 and recommend that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention. Representative Pugh, well, first of all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 3308 is before us. Representative Pugh, do you have an amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do. I have the A1.
All right. Representative Vogel would like to move the A1. All those in favor.
Did we just pass the bill?
Did we just pass the bill?
I thought we just voted to move the bill to public safety. Congratulations.
All right. I am sorry. I'm just trying to move so fast, I guess. I would like to have a motion to reconsider. Representative Johnson has a motion to reconsider House File 3308 that is now before us. Now, Representative Pugh has an A1 amendment. Representative Vogel has moved the A1. Any discussion on the A1? Thank you for catching that. Oh, wait a second.
Aye.
The motion to reconsider. We have to vote on that first.
Yep.
All those in favor of the motion to reconsider, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Yeah. Now we're before us. I'm sorry, Representative Pugh.
Yeah, I just think you do a great job.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that encouragement. Now, Representative Vogel will move the A1. The A1 is before us. Discussion on the A1. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 is adopted. Representative Pugh, so sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Civil Law Committee. I'm Cindy Pugh, representative for House District 33B, serving Carver County and Hennepin Counties. Thank you for hearing my bill. House File 3308, and it's been said, and I'd agree, based on the number of friends I know who have experienced family court, that regardless of the outcome, there are really no winners. The process of litigation and hearings takes a toll on families, and neither, in my opinion, are the best practices for people to settle their divorce. It's expensive, stressful, and not to mention the time it can take to actually get a hearing date. A lot of conflict can occur due to the adversarial court process. In the interest of well-being of families, my bill seeks to improve upon this process. I believe that consistent use of alternative dispute resolution, or ADR, could result in more favorable and less contentious outcomes for families versus the traditional court process. After all, after the divorce is final, the parties need to be able to effectively communicate in order to effectively co-parent their children. The purpose of this bill is to educate people about and to inform them that they have the option of using mediation. As committee members are surely aware, there are a growing number of pro se litigants, individuals who are representing themselves in court, many of whom cannot afford an attorney and are simply not aware of the option to use mediation. Alternative dispute resolution refers to any means of settling or resolving disputes outside of the courtroom and any method of resolving disputes other than by litigation. Mediation and arbitration are the two major forms of ADR. It's a process that can be used to resolve a family court matter instead of going to court. A process which encourages parties to resolve their differences so the judge doesn't have to be the one to make the decision for them. The main advantage of this form of dispute settlement is that it allows the parties themselves to control the process and the solution. According to Court Rule 310, and I believe that you may have a copy of that rule in your packets. If not, I have copies.
We do have it represented.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Madam Chair, all family law matters in district court are required to use an ADR process to resolve their divorce case, except in certain cases. I have a So you've got a copy of the rule. Specifically, it clarifies that it's not required in cases involving domestic abuse. Although many people are aware of their option to use mediation or ADR, many are not informed. So my bill requires the judge to provide an informational form about the ADR requirements in the general rules of practice to the parties regarding their use of ADR instead of using the court process. And this form will be given to them by the judge at their first hearing with the court. And most of the time, this will occur at the initial case management conference, also known as the ICMC. I have a sample of what that form might look like. I don't know if that's in your packet or not. However, I'll be working with the courts to draft the final version of the form. I want the committee to know that I have requested a fiscal note, and I'm still working through the process to identify the best, most cost-effective procedure with regard to this component of the bill. Since court files are now electronic, the form might just be given to the parties and not, in fact, filed with the court. These details will be worked out with the court prior to the next hearing with public safety. So I appreciate your support of the bill, your consideration, and I believe the bill will ultimately benefit families. I also believe if more families would choose to use mediation instead of the court process, there'd be a reduction in not only the use of the court calendar, but therefore a reduction to the courts as well, not to mention the benefit for families. So, Madam Chair, I had a testifier who went to plug her meter.
We thought you'd be longer.
Yes, I do have another testifier who can answer some questions and has a few things to say.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Diane Anderson, and I'm a former state representative. Mm-hmm. And I actually started getting involved in trying to reform family law matters over 25 years ago. My husband was previously married and had a child from a previous marriage. And we just got involved personally with issues, and I've been involved with a lot of citizen groups. And I was one of the people that was instrumental in passing the parenting plan legislation back in 2000. So well aware of what happens in our court systems and just trying to make things better for families. And you heard about, Marilyn's going to be telling you the benefits about mediation instead of using the adversarial court process. And just really the purpose of this bill is just to inform people of their option to use mediation and trying to help this growing population of the pro se litigants as well. And when I was a state representative, I sat in on some ICMC conferences, and the judge would talk to the parties, and he'd say, well, you have the option to go to E&E, or you have the option to use the court system, and he didn't tell the people that they actually did have an option of using mediation. So I'm not sure exactly. I've talked to some attorneys and people, and it could be maybe 50% of the time that the judge doesn't mention this. We don't have any statistics on this, but just would like to make sure that at this first hearing, so basically it's probably going to be the ICMC hearing. It's really great if you can have a judge telling people what options they have as well. It really puts a lot of emphasis behind it as well. And then just handing them a form so that they know, like in cases of where there's people that have domestic abuse, that they're not required to do it. So that would all be in the form. There's a sample form in front of you. It's just a sample. We'll be working with the courts, and they'll be the ones developing the form. But we really feel that there's a lot of benefits to the courts, that if more people use mediation, and there'd be a lot of benefits to people that are divorcing if they're more aware. So that's really the purpose of the bill.
Thank you, former Representative Anderson. And I understand there's another testifier. She has fed the meter. And so she's good to go for at least another, 40 minutes, hopefully, if you put a couple of quarters in. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Marilyn McKnight. I'm Marilyn McKnight, and I am owner of Erickson Mediation Institute. I'm on the board of the National Academy of Professional Family Mediators, and I'm chair of the board of the Professional Mediation Board of Standards, where we're developing nationally credentialing for mediators. I've been a mediator since 1977. My husband, Steve Erickson, and I started our practice in 77, third practice to open in the country, and we have been at the front of the mediation profession ever since then. What is interesting to me is that, you know, Minnesota was a state that started a lot of things, and mediation was one of them, family mediation. We did farm mediation in the 80s. We were the first state, went to federal law. This is a state that has really respected mediation all these years. However, I mediate divorces every day. That's my profession. That's what I do. In our practice, we do about 150 couples a year. And it is amazing to me that most of them have not heard of mediation. We receive calls all the time. How long has mediation been around? What is this? And I said, well, you know, you need to be informed early on that you can use an ADR process. Divorce mediation has been the most researched, has had the most client satisfaction of any mediation process, an ADR process for divorce. And it is truly a very, very successful process. And when families do mediate their divorces, they end up being following their decrees. They're very, very a very small percentage actually go back to court to renegotiate things later. When they do, they often go to mediation and settle it there. If we're really wanting to serve the families of Minnesota, it's time we let them know about the best kept secret, and that is that divorce mediation works extremely well, and it just needs to be put out there. And so when we have ADR processes, the court are saying they have to do that immediately. Let's serve the families and let them know about it.
Thank you. Any member questions for the testifiers? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me start by saying that the testifier was my mediation professor at William Mitchell College of Law as I was getting my law degree. Yes. So I just actually have a question, but it's not really before this committee. I assume between now and the next committee that there will be a fiscal note requested, that there will be some conversations with the court now that we're going to e-filing and there are no papers in the courtroom, what a notice looks like, what that might cost, what the implication might be. But the one question that I have is, so in Minnesota, you can get certified and do the 40 hours of certification, but there isn't a mandate, or at least last I checked, there was not a mandate that you have that requirement and training to be a mediator. So my question is, when they're given this form to say you may do mediation, are they going to be given anything about who mediators are, where they might find them, you know, how to watch out for good ones or bad ones, or who might be trained or not trained, or is there any guidance? If you're telling them, you know, you can do this, is there any guidance about actually finding one if they want to?
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, first of all, yes, your assumption is correct that we have already requested a fiscal note and are looking forward to receiving that. And as I mentioned, I mentioned the draft of the letter that I think is in your packets is just that, a draft, and I have not given specific consideration to the point, the concern that you brought up, but I assure you that I will, as we're working with the courts to come up with what this form looks like, we'll definitely take that into consideration. I mean, that's a very good and important point, so definitely will.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one. Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 3308 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to Public Safety and Crime Prevention. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. No. You're on your way, Representative Pugh. Thank you.
Thank
you're on
Madam
your way
Karen.
To Public Safety and Crime Prevention.
Thank you very much, members of the committee.
Representative Daniels, thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
We have enough chairs there for everybody? Welcome to the committee. I'm going to go ahead and move House File 2742 and recommend that it be referred to the General Register. Representative Daniels, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. House File 2742 has to do with closed captioning in public places. It hits pretty near to me. My oldest son is deaf. That's why we moved to Faribault. My campaign manager is deaf, and we work together as best we can, and I'm not as good a sign as the interpreters that are here today, but I do my best to communicate. My campaign manager actually keeps track of a lot of our committee meetings, and I believe until this year there was no closed captioning available on the TV presentation of the committee meetings. Now I was talking to our photographer, and he has new technologies they bought last year, and they're implementing them. So I think it's up and running now. But you know, for people that can't hear what's going on, it's very difficult to, you know, see what's going on in the news. You know, just the everyday things are a little bit harder. So I'm hoping this bill will be received positively for the people who are either deaf or are hard of hearing. I just got some numbers today. 1% of Minnesotans are deaf, and 20% of Minnesotans are hard of hearing. So it does affect a majority, you know, of the public, or quite a few in the public sector there. So that's what I'm hoping to do, is to get closed captioning on TVs that have the ability to have closed captioning, and just make it easier for people with the hard of hearing or the deaf community to know what's going on and news broadcasts, all those type of things.
Great, thank you. And do you have some testifiers with you?
I do. Jan Johnson is to my left. She's going to be testifying this morning. And then Beth Frazier to my right will also be testifying. We'll start with maybe Jan, if that's okay.
Wonderful. If she could introduce herself for the committee, that would be wonderful.
Hello, Madam Chair and members. Thank you, Representative Daniels. My name is Jan McCready Johnson. Thank you for allowing me to testify. This is a very important subject for me with the deaf and hard of hearing community. Not having captions is, you know, or having captions is a lifesaver. And, you know, being able to watch TV without sound would be an equivalent for deaf people watching and not being able to understand because of no captions. You know, being able to feel connected with the world is an important thing for us. And having captions in a public place came from my experience in Maryland. They have a law that all TVs in public places are to be captioned. And I was very pleased that Representative Daniels proposed this bill. So we are often left in the dark, you know, as regards to what is going on. And a big impact on me was I was in the hospital waiting room. I was sitting watching TV with no captions. And all of the sudden, breaking news hit with the Boston Marathon. I'm like, what is going on? What is happening? People are running all over the place. What is going on? I'm sitting here in this waiting room thinking, what happened? There's no captions. I felt terrible, frustrated, you know, and hearing people were flocking to the TVs, but not me. You know, that really left a big impact on me. And having those closed captionings in, you know, in all of the hospitals, waiting rooms, or any public places, libraries, you know, captioning makes me, or gives me the ability to connect instead of feeling isolated and uninformed. You know, maybe Representative can explain further, but you know, I would really like to see this implemented and become a law so that we as deaf people or hard of hearing people don't have to fight and beg and plead for captions. Oh, I don't know how to do it. This, I don't know how to put it on this TV is what we often hear, but having it mandated that it's there. And as he stated, 1% are deaf and 20% of Minnesotans are hard of hearing. Sometimes it does seem like a small number, but it's a huge help. And it's a big impact to those of us who are part of those numbers. So I'm hoping that you guys will support this bill. And thank you, Madam Chair and members. And thanks, Representative Daniel.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Ms. Fraser?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Fraser, the Government Relations Director for the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. Thank you for taking the time to hear the bill and for Representative Daniels for carrying it. We appreciate the stakeholders' openness to the bill. I've talked to the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Counties, the School Boards Association, and the townships, and they are all, they do not have concerns about the bill. They are not opposed to the bill, so they are neutral on the bill. And last year, we had a bill that had a hearing in the Senate, and after the bill was passed, the Restaurant Association raised some concerns because that bill was broader. And so after that hearing, we still wanted to take a step forward. And after Ms. Johnson's testimony, especially about the worry of being in a hospital and not knowing what was going on, I approached the Hospital Association and really appreciated their willingness to look at this issue and potential willingness to have this apply to them. And so we worked with them to have an amendment that passed unanimously on the floor for the HHS bill. And unfortunately, it didn't make it into law last year, so we have come back and have, the only thing we've changed from last year is putting it into the Human Rights Act. Last year there was a cross-reference to the Human Rights Act. Last year we put it into the hospital statute to make it germane to the HHS bill. So I just learned last night that the Hospital Association had some questions about why it was in this statute versus that statute, and I'm sure that they will speak for themselves about that. But do want to say that this is the statute where we talk about accessibility and accommodating folks with disabilities. And that there, of course, are remedies that apply, but in some ways this is a different type of reasonable accommodation than others, in that all that you have to do to accommodate is turn the captioning on and leave it on. And there's even language that says if it's inadvertently turned off, all you have to do is turn it on. And so it's different than needing to widen a door or build a new ramp or something else that would take time and money to accomplish. This is fairly simple. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, if somebody is deaf or hard of hearing and requests to have the closed captioning on, it's already required. So if the captioning isn't on and somebody requests it, under federal law, they're already required to turn it on. The point of this is just to ensure that folks have it on when they go into the room and don't have to ask somebody to turn it on. There is also already a right of action under the ADA. So there is already a remedy in place if it was inadvertently turned on and they asked somebody and they refused to turn it on. But I find that hard to believe that that would happen. So just want to emphasize that while this for a hearing person doesn't seem like that big a deal, it really can be a big deal if if you don't have access to the information, and can be scary in, you know, cases of a national emergency. So want to encourage your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser. Any member questions? Representative Smith. I was just going to add here for a second. I think I did talk to Representative Daniels about this yesterday. And on page 2, line 3, I believe we have the wrong reference, the wrong chapter there. It says chapter 114, and I believe it's 144. So, Representative Daniels, would you like to have an oral amendment to correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. I forgot. That was in my notes, and I forgot. If we could do a verbal amendment to change line 2, or section 2, line 3, to read 144 instead of 114.
All right. Any discussion on that? Line 2.3, changing the chapter number from 114 to 144. Any discussion? All those in favor of that oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, I do believe you had a question. Okay. Very good. Any member questions? Ms. Fraser, if you could stay at the desk. I have a question, and that is, you mentioned that it seems like this may be already covered by the ADA. And so is this bill really necessary if it's already covered under the ADA?
Madam Chair and members, I may not have been clear, and I apologize if I wasn't. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, if somebody requests a reasonable accommodation, and turning on the closed captioning would be considered a reasonable accommodation, it needs to be provided. And if it is easy to provide, and in this case it's pretty easy to provide, pushing a button. And so if the institution or the government entity refused and said, no, I don't care that you're deaf or hard of hearing and you want to have the captions, I refuse to turn them on, that would be a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The difference between the Americans with Disabilities Act and this law or this proposal is whether the default is that they are on. This says that they will be on, that people who are deaf and hard of hearing can expect that when they go into a hospital waiting room or to a program put on by a government entity, the default is that they are already on, that they won't have to find somebody to ask to turn them on. They won't have to figure out where is the remote, does it have batteries, you know, and how to turn it on. So it's about what is the default.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there anyone in the... Oh, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I have a concern and a question that last session this bill was in a different area, as you testified to, of the law. And my concern is that perhaps that might be the better area for it to provide a more proper resolution. There's a concern that this could bring some unnecessary encumber some litigation for something that can be solved in an easier way. Do you, so for this to not be in the human rights area?
Representative Fraser.
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto denied me that title. So I... Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Smith.
Yes.
I think there are a few questions about that, especially with where we are in session right now. I mean, one is that this is the statute where I think that often deals with reasonable accommodations, with accommodations for people with disabilities. That's the first thing. The second thing is that this statute also allows for complaints to the Department of Human Rights. And so there is actually an easy, non-litigious way of dealing with a problem were there somebody who refused to turn on the closed captioning. The other issue at this point in session is if this were moved into Chapter 144, for example, it would need to have a hearing in yet another committee, and I'm worried that we wouldn't meet first deadline. So, I mean, I think that there are logical reasons to put it in this statute. And maybe I'm naive about this, but it just seems like since all you have to do to comply is turn it on once and keep it on, and then if somebody turns it off, turn it back on. It just seems, it's hard for me to believe that there would be lawsuits about that, because, again, it's different than the need to change the size of a door, which would take time and money and which can't be done immediately.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate your answer, and I'm working on a bill concerning the ADA law this session, and I just want to restate my concern for this bill being in this area, and I have significant concern about that, and it might be better for a different area of the law. I certainly understand the time pressure element, and I just have concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against the bill or comment on it otherwise? Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'd like to just start out by saying, and a lot of people don't know this, but the word hospital actually comes from the Greek word hospitality. And hospitals were meant to be a place of caring, not just for the sick person, but for the family members and the loved ones who came to visit their family. So the word hospital and hospitality came from the same root word. And so the Hospital Association, and I want to be clear, is not opposed to the underlying premise of this bill. We actually want to welcome our hard of hearing and deaf family members to come to the hospital, and we appreciate what they're trying to do in this legislation. So I just want to say that up front. We have a concern regarding being placed in the Human Rights Act, because we do think that that lends itself to possible litigation, and particularly the lines on the last, on 2.26 of the bill, where it says, as soon as possible. So it's the combination of being in the Human Rights Act and in the wording, as soon as possible. If there was some way to say that we would be able to turn on the televisions as soon as practical, I don't know the exact wording, to be honest with you, but the two together, being in the Human Rights Act and is saying as soon as possible. A lot of our smaller hospitals, we have 78 critical access hospitals that don't have a lot of administrative staff there, particularly on a weekend or something. There literally may not be somebody. If all the staff is involved in patient care, what does soon as possible really mean? And so we're a little nervous about that language in combination with being in the Human Rights Act. As was mentioned before, last year this legislation affected Chapter 144, which is the hospital licensure section of law, and we were more comfortable with it being under Chapter 144, directly dealing with hospitals rather than being part of the Human Rights Act. So if there's some way to maybe change that language a little bit to give us more time, we're a little worried about what does as soon as possible mean if there isn't anybody available. And so I just wanted to share that with the committee.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to ask staff if there was something in statute, in definition otherwise, that has been, and it looks like they're already maybe looking, but that fits what is as soon as possible. I mean, I got to believe this isn't the first time that this has come up.
Representative Blush.
You know, this comes up from time to time, you know, and I appreciate the Hospital Association wants to I guess tailor this to their specific needs, but this is meant to address, I mean, more than just hospital situation. And sometimes this will come up in committee when there's open-ended language on that. And remember that at the end of the day, this is the ubiquitous and mysterious reasonable man in the law definition, okay, which means that it's up to a jury to decide. So ultimately, if it came down to it, it would be a jury of peers to decide whether or not there was a violation of this. And I have to think that juries take into consideration, if it's a small hospital with low staff, that someone can't vault over the nurse's desk and go quickly flip the thing right away. I think as soon as possible is, I feel like, is a reasonable accommodation in the statute that would be considered by any trier of fact, whether that be a judge or a jury, not giving rise to unreasonable lawsuits, because there's no way that you could win that argument before a court. There's no way, unless someone was being an overwhelming jerk and there was evidence to back that up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that was kind of my point, was that this is, I don't believe that this is the first usage of that language in state statute or rule or otherwise. So, but I'll just finish with this. Representative Daniels, thank you. This is a good bill. I plan on supporting it, and it's the right thing to do. I think that it's a great example of exactly what your testifier said about watching the Boston bombing marathon and being excluded in our society. And the Lord knows we have plenty of that that comes out of this legislature once in a while with proposals that really does push to exclude people. And I'm glad to see that we're doing more to for inclusion than exclusion.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, and then Representative Hillstrom.
Just a couple things. One, going back to what Representative Lesch was talking about, yeah, it's great. We have a jury of our peers. The problem is that could cost thousands and thousands of dollars and increase the cost of the patients to get that ruling. So I think we need to get a little more clarification on that before this bill goes forward. I love this bill. It needs to be done. In fact, I was at my clinic a couple months ago for one of my checkups, and they had the closed captioning on. But I also know at my dad's house, and also at a business that my father-in-law owns, they got turned on by accident. My dad, after a week, finally called me, how do I get this on? Some people just don't know how to operate that. And sometimes if you don't have the remote there, or the remote's out of batteries, because all you do is have the TV's on all the time, they might not be able to turn it back on if a little kid got up and hit the right button to turn it off. So what is as soon as possible, as soon as they can find somebody that can figure out how to run the TV, which could take a couple days sometimes, if that person who operates that is not there. My father-in-law's business, a young child got his hands on the remote and changed some settings, and we had to actually have a tech come in from the satellite company to get things set back. So sometimes it's not as easy as possible. That's why we need to have things a little more defined, I think, in this. But I do want this bill, and I do want those people to have that. So I am going to move this forward if we have the vote, because I think it is important. But I think we just need to work a few things out.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually think I can be a little helpful here on line 2.26. Reactivated as soon as possible should really be as soon as practicable. That is really the legal term that typically is used, and that really does take into account the ability to get it done in a practicable sense, reasonable, sensible, workable, achievable, doable. Those are the definitions, and so that's really the more legally appropriate word, I think, here, and should alleviate many of the concerns.
Thank you. Representative Daniels.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. It's actually in two spots, 2.17 and 2.26, and we are totally okay with changing that to either
practical
or reasonable, whatever works best in the legal. We have a lot of legal counsel here, so I'll let them pick the right word. But that is very acceptable to me and our people that are presenting the bill today.
And could I hear from the hospital folks again on that?
I know we always try to get peace in the valley. I think that Representative Hillstrom's language, if we could also add that to the line on 2.17, I think that this seems like a good accommodation, and we're very appreciative. That, I think, would help some of our smaller hospitals who raise this concern. So thank you. I think we're good.
All right.
So if we could have that amendment in two places, that'd be great.
All right. Representative Hillstrom, you want to move that amendment?
I would, Madam Chair, I would move that on line 2.17 and on 2.26, instead of the word possible, it would be practicable. practicable.
Thank you. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. I still do have concerns that it's in the human rights section and the possibilities of, you know, litigation. We're going to go ahead and move this to the general register, and I would just ask that you continue to work on that. Maybe I know the Hospital Association said that they were okay with the word changes here that we made, too, but they also did cite the issues of having it in the human rights statute, and there were some member concern with that, too. So we'll go ahead and move it out of here today, but I want you to take those thoughts into consideration and see if some work can still be done on this. All right? All those in favor of passage of House File 2742, that it be re-referred to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, just a reminder again that we will be, did I already mention that we're going to probably be meeting Tuesday night? We're going to be meeting Tuesday night. plan on Tuesday night. It is deadline week. The fun has just begun. So it's your knitting night. You can bring here knit. You can bring it here and knit while you sit and listen to bills. Oh, book club. Well, sorry about that. We'll have to go on without you. With that, members, we are adjourned. Have a happy Easter.